Welcome, everyone, to episode 29 of the Academy of Management's Origin series, where we ask the question of where does theory come from? How are conceptual papers developed? What does their path to publication look like? In the hope that people can learn from what others have done. And one of the things about doing this series has been to discover how different many of these conceptual papers are. And I think today's paper that we're going to discuss, entitled It's All Fun and Games Until Someone Gets Hurt, An Interactional Framing Theory of Work, Social, Sexual Behavior, is going to be one of those that is unique. It's novel. It's intriguing. It draws from theories that we might not typically draw from in management theory. So I'm thrilled to have the authors of this paper here to just discuss their journey of writing a conceptual paper around workplace sexual behavior, which is highly topical. So Shannon Rorsky, Anne O'Leary Kelly, and Denise Bro-Saunier. Welcome to the Academy of Management Origin series. It's great to have you here. And it's just going to be such fun to talk about the development of this paper and how you, number one, came up with these ideas, number two, managed to evolve them into this coherent whole, and then number three, managed to push them through the publication process, which is not necessarily easy and can be arduous at times. Okay, so we've got our three authors with us, and before we go any further, I'd just like them to quickly introduce themselves in the order that they listed on the paper. So we'll start with Shannon, and then go over to Anne, and then Denise. Shannon?
Hi, my name is Shannon Rossi. I'm an assistant professor of organizational behavior at Ivy Business School at Western University in Canada. My research expertise is on the topics of sexual harassment and also sexual harassment and diversity training effectiveness. In particular, I'm interested in studying how people understand or make sense of ambiguous social sexual behaviors, and then also how do people react to sexual harassment and diversity training, especially backlash reactions or negative reactions.
Thank you. Anne?
My name is Anne O'Leary Kelly. I'm the William and Cecilia Howard Chair in Management in the Sam M. Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas. And my research has been in a couple of areas that sort of merged together in this paper. One of those relates to gender-based violent, aggressive behavior at work around sexual harassment and also intimate partner violence. But I also have just a fundamental interest in identity, how we present ourselves in the world, how we construct our sense of self. And both of those themes are pretty evident in the paper we're going to talk about today.
Denise?
Hi, I'm Denise Bro-Saunier. I'm an associate teaching professor in the Sam M. Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas. And my research interests have always centered around understanding dysfunction, understanding why bad things happen, why people do the things that they do that they shouldn't be doing. So whether that's, the topic of the current paper or, deviance and behaviors like that or organizational politics, all of those things, it's there's always a lens of dysfunction on there.
Well, thank you. Well, that's great introductions, gives us a chance now to dive into the paper. So thanks very much. So to kick us off, just as a reminder to everyone, the title of the paper, It's All Fun and Games Until Someone Gets Hurt, An Interactional Framing Theory of Work, Social, Sexual Behavior. Can you give us a little bit of a snapshot or an elevator pitch of what this paper is about?
Sure, I can take that one. So this paper is really about contributing to our understanding of social sexual behavior in the workplace and how it gets framed as either playful or sexually harassing, depending on how employees in a work group negotiate for its meaning over time and over a series of interactions that develop into patterns. So we did shift the focus from the individual level and looking at differences in perceptions, which is where the literature had been for quite a while, and we shift that up to the interactional level of analysis, looking at different features of interactions and patterns over time that can help explain how behavior can maybe start off as a verbal joke and escalate into something much more egregious over time, and how those even very dramatic instances of sexual behavior can still be framed as play, but then also dramatically shift like that to a framing of sexual harassment. So that's really the premise of the papers, teasing out, well, where is that line in the sand between sexual joking and sexual harassment? And what we come to learn through the theory and through the paper is there is no line in the sand. The same exact behaviors can be framed as play or sexual harassment, depending on this negotiation for meaning that takes place in work groups.
So when you say the interactional level as opposed to the individual level, does that mean it's dyadic? Does that mean it's broader than dyadic? Is it elevating up to teams? Is it elevating up to organizations? How do you conceptualize this notion of the interactional level before we go any further?
I would say our model is very meso in nature. So the structure of the model follows interactional patterns through a triple helix, if you look at the figure in the model, which was very fun. I'm sure we'll get to the picture of the model eventually, but that was fun to draw out and also create in a graphic. So the actual structure of the model is looking at interactional patterns and sort of a cyclical pattern of how interactions develop over time. But we also include individual goals as a factor that affects those patterns, as well as how work group goals are interdependent. So we have some group level things going on. And then organizational level as well, we have cultural factors that play a role. So it's meso in that it's sort of considering the whole scope of different levels of phenomena, but our main focus is the patterns of interaction over time.
Interesting. Fascinating. Thank you. So who's the paper for? No doubt it's topical. I mean, we've all seen Me Too, Harvey Weinstein, everything else that's going on. So I would expect, you know, there's almost any potential broad audience for this. But when you think about it from a scholarly standpoint, who do you see as the target audience or the kind of scholars who are going to pick this up and read it and carry forward ideas from it into their own research?
Yeah, I'm glad to take that one. I think what we hope is that it helps scholars think about sexual harassment in a broader way than the individual level, as Shannon said. I think a lot of our research has really gotten stuck over time at that level. We seem to have a really great period of research on sexual harassment back in the early 1990s, kind of late 1980s after Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill, and then into the 1990s, and case law is developing, and there was a lot going on. But then we sort of headed into a fallow period. And so I think for us, this paper is one that helps us remind scholars there are a whole lot of ways to think about research on sexual harassment beyond some of those initial questions we started with. And thinking about it within these international dynamics was really intriguing to us. You asked Greg about where the ideas come from. You mentioned that in the intro. And really, this paper started, we used to call it the humor paper. It started because we wanted to understand how people use humor in sexual harassment situations. And then they can kind of get a pass when they say, well, I was just joking. And that led us away from thinking about an individual actor using this tactic on an individual target or victim into those interactional patterns where all this develops and evolves. And that's really what got us into the Goffman's framing work and this interactional focus. So we hope people come on this journey too with us and think about sexual harassment in these broader and different kinds of ways.
Wonderful. Thanks. That's extremely insightful and revealing. So tell us a little bit more about that journey. So you came at it from a humor angle. How would you describe the evolution of the ideas over time? Because you land up, and we will get to the model in a moment, but you land up with a, a sophisticated model, has multiple elements to it, quite a lot of theoretical ideas that are drawn on and incorporated at different levels of analysis. Can you give us a sense how you go from talking about joking, humor, trying to infuse workplace situations with sort of funny quirks and that being associated with sort of sexual behavior, to the point where you're untangling social sexual behavior and sexual harassment in this very sophisticated way?
Happy to start with that. I can start. So Greg was what I love. I mean, I love being in the room with these women because it brings back such great memories. My favorite thing about this paper is like the journey, not just in the paper, but just the incredible journeys that all of us have been on in the last 11 years that we, since we started this paper. I think it was like,
oh, it's 12 to in print.
So 12 years. Right. And so, it's just lovely to think back and to think about where we started. And so I'll take the early years, which was, you know, probably the first couple of years we worked on this, which was just kind of that initial question that Shannon Ann mentioned, which is, you know, we wanted to understand, of course, this kind of behavior, but in the context of humor and how that played a role. And like, so that led us to this question of, well, what makes something funny versus not funny? And I remember that became sort of our central question of discussion. And we would meet on Saturdays in my office for like 4 or 5 hours. Sometimes Anne would bring her dog. No one would be there. And we would just have a whiteboard and we would, you know, I mean, we went everywhere with this thing. And somehow we landed on Goffman, on this book that I absolutely love. And, you know, but don't want
to. Just for those listening, it's Goffman and it's frame analysis. Yeah, so
frame analysis is what we landed on, right? And so this is Goffman's. Very dense, just absolutely fascinating, but incredibly dense. I mean, I've read this multiple times, you know, theorizing about humor and what makes something funny versus not funny. And he begins with things like, you know, discussing animal behavior and how if we watch two animals, we can understand whether they're playing or whether they're not because they give each other signals. So, you know, two cats that are, you know, play fighting, are going to look a certain way versus two cats that are really fighting. Their body language will change. Their sounds will change. So they do certain things. Sometimes they go from playing to not playing, right? And so we stumble upon all of these little like tidbits, right? Like, oh, what makes them go from playing to not playing, right? What are the signs? And Goffman has just, he answers all of these things in such an interesting way in this book. But I would say we probably spent Did we spend 2 years like dissecting this?
Oh, probably longer than that, Denise.
Yeah.
Probably longer than that. Because, yeah, as I remember, we started out with the humor literature. And then somewhere along the way, just tracking down the web of citations in these papers about humor, I think you were the one that found Goffman. You're like, hey, guys, I found this book. And then we all bought the book. And then we all read it. And it's one of those books you have to read the same paragraph like 3, 4, 5 times to really like, it's a thinker. And there are just crazy examples in there. Like my favorite is the drunk guy who shoots the puppet because he thinks it's the devil. And it's just like, yeah, how are people making sense of their day-to-day interactions? And it's just really like a foundational piece in understanding how human beings communicate, convey meaning, how we socially coordinate. And that was the game changer for this paper because we went from, you know, why is something funny to really understanding of how do we make sense of these complex, ambiguous social interactions that could have multiple meanings. It's not just funny, not funny. It could, you know, sexual behaviors in the workplace could be romantic. They could be considered a job role, right? If you're working in as an exotic dancer, they could be considered friendship, right? So we might share intimate details about our life to form a friendship. So there's many different ways of understanding the same kind of behavior. And really Goffman sort of sent us on a trajectory to get into that complexity and move away from the simplicity of, is it harassment or not?
And I think a key insight there too for us was that Goffman helped us understand how much weird behavior people will accept when it's contained in a play frame.
I just want to clarify, was the play frame, is that Goffman's term or did you invoke that term?
That's Goffman.
Okay.
It's Goffman 101.
Because that's very central to your whole argument. And it explains how you go from humor to sexual harassment. Is one is under the auspices of this play frame, and then it sort of transitions out of that into other things. And so it's helpful just to understand. So Goffman gives you that sort of theoretical apparatus, if you will, to begin to understand what's going on there.
Yeah, I think it started with sort of a mind blow of, okay, this really helps us see how people can behave in very bizarre ways in the workplace if they put a play frame around it. Because if you're removed from that and look at it, you think, how in the world could that possibly have happened with rational people in a workplace? But Goffman helped us see not just that does happen, that play frame is very flexible and can expand, but also gave us tools for diagnosing when and how that begins to happen, that you can bracket a play frame, you can intentionally set it in a way that then pulls other people into that play frame. And when they come into that play frame, it begins to take on a life of its own and to sustain or contain people in that play frame. So giving us the tools to make sense of that and to use it to interpret sexual harassment interactions was just an incredible, incredible experience to be able to begin to have those tools available to us, because we were grasping around before that how to think about humor in this place. But it's because it's fundamentally a social dynamic. It's fundamentally a social interaction. And there are ways to predict how those things are going to unfold. So it was a huge insight for us.
And then I'll add to the latter half of that story. When we got to the review process, the review team really pushed us to develop our theory beyond Goffman. So I remember one of the reviewers commenting, so all you're doing here is just applying Goffman's frame analysis to sexual behaviors at work. And we had this lengthy conversation of what is special about our paper other than just applying Goffman, because it is such a foundational theory. It would be easy for us to just stop at that point and give people new insights just based on Goffman, but that's not theory development. So we went back and we thought about, well, Goffman was a sociologist. He wasn't really thinking about people in work organizations. And so something we really added to extend Goffman's thoughts was what happens when you embed frame analysis in an organizational structure with power hierarchies. And there's that section in the paper that sort of flips the play signals on their head and say, hey, these can actually turn into very clear sexual harassment signals when you look at how power is overlaid in organizational structure. When you look at sexual harassment law and policy, the same exact things that are signaling play are signaling sexual harassment. So that was an advancement in our own theoretical thinking that came out of the review process, which I think took the paper in a really productive direction.
I think that's so interesting. You know, without ever conversing about this, we just laid out really the three stages of this project. You know, sort of the pre-Goffman, where we were thinking about it as humor, then discovering Goffman and seeing how that gave us a framing, a framing for our paper. And then the post-Goffman, which is what Shannon just described so well, which is what is our unique contribution to this other than just taking Goffman and applying him.
Fascinating to understand that evolution and to just appreciate it. At the center of this all is this model that we've already alluded to. And I think what's interesting are a few things here. Number one is you introduce the model on page 2 of the paper. So as opposed to what we often see in other conceptual papers where there's a whole lot of theoretical background and you're almost diving straight into it already in the introduction, which is an interesting choice. And then this model is fairly complex. It's got a lot going on. So what I'd like to do is just, you know, I'm going to pull the model up on the screen, if you don't mind, and just ask one of you to sort of talk us through, number one, what's going on, but then we can visit how did this develop and evolve as this model that becomes so central to the whole paper. So I'm going to bring it up on the screen here. And if you can just give us a sense of what's going on here from sort of top to bottom, or and refer to the left and right, if you will, and then we can talk about how it evolved.
So just to give you an overview, we have this triple helix structure to the model, and it's really meant to convey to the reader that this is not a linear process. It's cyclical, and you can go around in different loops within the model for quite a while, but then something about the interaction changes or shifts. There's a limit test, and you might skip down to another cycle. Towards the later stages of writing this paper, we actually recognized that there could be more branches off the center sense-making cycle, and you could start framing things as, you know, maybe a romantic relationship that might be developing in the workplace, and oh, maybe I'm reading the signals wrong, I'll go back to sense making, maybe it's just joking around, I'll go up here. So there could be more offshoots off the center sense making circle, but for, you know, development purposes, we stuck with the two contrasting play and sexual harassment. So essentially, you're just sort of traveling around the cycles. You have interaction stability where everybody agrees this sexual behavior in the workplace is playful. Something might trigger someone to question that. And then you have a state of vulnerability where you can't actually interact until you decide what's going on and what role everyone is playing. That's the middle cycle, the sense-making cycle. And then once things sort of get dysfunctional enough, the organization steps in and starts investigating and sorting out what is actually going on here. And in many cases, the organization will recognize those play signals as sexual harassment signals, and they'll use sense giving to sort of force on that sexual harassment frame. And then employees are essentially, because of their job requirements, are required to comply with that sexual harassment frame, and they spend some time cycling in the lower level, but it's very difficult for them to accept that framing. On the side there, we have the up keying and down keying, which is just meant to represent the play signals that sort of lift the interaction up into stability or shift the interaction down into the fragility. So that's a brief overview, but it took a long time to get to this dynamic of a model. We actually started out with more of a linear boxes and arrows sort of model that was much less dynamic.
So can you talk me through a little bit just of how did you sort of go from the boxes and arrows to this more dynamic thing, both in terms of just the evolution of ideas, but then also just your own interaction as an author team and sort of generating breakthroughs or advancements in your conceptualization of this model? What was sort of going on that allowed you to go from one mini breakthrough to the next, to the next?
I think one thing that was important for us is, and this goes back to our journey of learning and developing the ideas, is that the boxes and arrows just don't work when you're talking about these complex social dynamics that are in motion. So even if you've got a recursive boxes and arrows model, it's just not fluid enough. And so once we exited that early phase where we were thinking about this as humor and sexual harassment, there was just no way to contain that once we got into the Goffman stuff, there was no way to contain that in a boxes and arrows model. And so that's really what led to what, you know, still when I look at it, I have to laugh because it's just a little crazy and overwhelming, but there's just nothing else that would do is essentially what we came to. And so even though it's a little complex and crazy, it's the only thing that we found that could work to describe what we wanted to say here.
And I think the process of that, this is really making me think back to how we got from where we started to here. I think something we did well, although I think we all found it frustrating throughout the process at times, was, you know, we didn't know what the answer was. We were learning. I mean, we didn't have an answer to a question. We wanted to write it down. We had a question and we wanted to find the right answer. And every time we would come up with a boxes and arrows model, and we would, you know, read something else and maybe change a little and add a little, and we'd talk through it for a while. And eventually we'd say, something's missing. Like, we're not there. And it took a long time to get to where we wanted it to be, but we allowed ourselves to keep trying. And every time we realized it just still wasn't right, we just kept digging in and learning more.
I think that's such an insightful, intriguing, valuable perspective on theorizing, is that often as scholars, we want to know the answer and be able to explain it immediately. But if it's that easy to do, then it's probably not worth explaining and theorizing about and writing an AMR paper about. It's through the posing of a challenging question that when you set out, you don't know exactly how you're going to answer it. And the exploration in search of trying to figure out that question, that new and interesting and novel theory comes about. And I think that you've been able to capture that through that explanation, Denise. So thank you. That's very valuable.
I would add to that, Greg, that it also explains why you stick with it for so long, because you know there's something there, and you just have to keep trying until you get to it. So that's what keeps you on this journey for the years and years that it can take to write good theory.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've learned through doing these interviews, is just how long these projects, these ones that are impactful, that people read and go, wow, how long they take. We, you know, as doctoral students or as junior scholars, we want to do things like tomorrow. But really, it's through the interaction, through the exploration, through the time invested that a lot of these novel insights emerge. So you've got this fascinating model, and I've still got it, kept it on the screen because I think it's intriguing. But then you do layer in, and this model would be viewed to be much more of a sort of narrative, processional, but it's not a linear process. It's an interactional process style model. And yet you still end up with propositions in the paper. Talk to me about the engineering this interaction between a fairly complex interactional model and propositions that are specifying things in a more clear sort of causal kind of way. What came first? When did the propositions come in versus the model get developed? And how did you arrive at having both as sort of central theoretical apparatus to convey your ideas?
So I think the review process really played a role here, because we always had propositions, some kind of propositions through the different working drafts of this paper. It got presented at multiple conferences. Like, we always had some propositions, but the earlier propositions were very much like, take the Goffman concept and apply it to this context. And it was that first round of reviews that pushed us beyond that. And so I think you mentioned earlier about, we made a choice to walk people through the infrastructure of the model in the first few pages and present them the picture of the model, and then move on to really where I think most of the theory is happening after we present the picture of the model. And that was to get out of this, to get out of Goffman's shadow, essentially. So we walk people through the basic foundations of frame analysis, as Goffman laid out, and that's the structure of the triple helix. And then where our theorizing comes into play is thinking about what are the features of the workplace that come into play in this phenomenon. And that's where you see some of the organizational culture and the goal interconnectedness and interdependence playing a role in this process, because it is embedded in an organization. And so after that first round of reviews, our propositions changed from just a simple application of, you know, this is what frame breaking is, to more testable sorts of propositions that are very nuanced based on organizational factors.
You know, I think the other thing about putting it up front, the description of the model up front, that was helpful, and I don't know that we saw this at the time, but in retrospect, is that a very common mistake, I think, in developing propositions around theory is to just describe the mechanics of the model. This goes to this, and this goes to this. But if you first describe the mechanics of your model, you can't build the rest of your paper around propositions that are about mechanics. It pushes you then to say, okay, what does this do for us? How does this expand our knowledge of the phenomenon, not just the movement? And so I think it took us a while to get there. That's not a typical way to do it. You're right, Greg, but I think it, you know, for the reason Shannon described and I just described, I think it really was necessary to us getting to where we got to with the paper.
And I think it's an interesting notion for people who want to develop conceptual papers, theoretical papers that are drawing heavily from a prior theoretical perspective, that's especially if it's non-organizational, such that they can utilize those ideas in their fullest capacity, but not just layer them on and specify them as be like you pushing a little further as you've described. And I think the sort of structure of your paper and the fact that you do double down on Goffman very quickly and then go beyond is a good example of what does it take to actually make a contribution when you're drawing on someone else's work, theoretical work, to do that. So I think that's very, very valuable. One of the two of the questions I'd like to ask, the one is about invoking examples in the paper and how do you find those examples? How do you make them fit? Obviously, these are interesting examples. They're examples of workplace sexual behavior. They're examples of, the police force interacting across gender in interesting and weird ways and exotic dances and all sorts of things. So firstly, the examples are very interesting. And then the second thing I want to ask about is you work on this paper for all these years, and then Me Too and Harvey Weinstein happens at the time this sort of paper sort of coming to fruition. So what impact did that have on your thinking and on your on any kind of evolution of the paper as you were developing it? So firstly, the examples, and then the sort of the thunderbolt of Me Too.
Well, I think early on we knew we wanted a lot of examples. As I remember, we overdid it on examples in the early version of this paper.
That's why I was laughing. I was like, oh, the example question.
Yeah. And I think part of that was our own energy around Me Too. I mean, as you say, it's unfolding right around us. And there were so many examples. And so I think that was a little bit of a rabbit hole for us too, of getting so tied up in that it was pulling us. It wasn't bringing our theory forward. It was becoming a bit of the point of our paper. And so our reviewers were really helpful in that, in checking and pulling us back.
And it seems like they mostly landed you on examples that had come from prior academic studies, or you landed on examples that had come from prior academic studies, because you could open any newspaper at that point in time and find an example.
Yeah.
But that almost became overwhelming to the paper by the sounds of things.
Yeah, that's an insightful comment, because that is where we ended up. I think we started with those more current examples, and that just wasn't helping us develop theory. It was allowing us to connect this to current events. And a good theory paper isn't about current events, right? It's about standing the test of time. I will say it was interesting this morning, there was an article in the New York Times about the Me Too movement and regression away from that, how organizations and industries are slipping back. And the model would predict that very thing, but it would also predict that That's a very, very fragile place because we've seen what we've seen, we've named what we've named, and so it can't be contained as easily as it was before Me Too. So, you know, I thought that was interesting. We were having this meeting today when that article came out this morning.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing I would add to that is, and I don't know if other people struggle with this, but sometimes I struggle with writing discussion sections because you just feel like you run out of steam. And one thing that I really liked about our discussion section is we pull some examples of findings from previous research that you can reanalyze through our theoretical lens and gain new insights from. So I think there's something about the common finding that men and women on average have different maybe thresholds for what they will label as sexual harassment or not harassment, with women being a little more sensitive and men being a little more tolerant. And, you know, in the past that would have just been, oh, there's a perceptual difference between men and women, but we can reinterpret that finding through our model. And it gives us new insights about why that might be the case and how it might have implications beyond just gender differences. And so I think we really pushed ourselves in the discussion section to think about old findings in new ways and also imagine new research questions and directions for future research. So I'm really happy with how we did cite some of those older studies that weren't the Me Too stories in the newspapers, but we were able to show through our theoretical lens how we can understand those past findings in a new way.
What are the most, any one of you, or all three of you for that matter, the most exciting sort of future research direction? What platform does this paper create that you would be excited to either pursue yourself or have others see others pursuing it as sort of part of their research program? Which piece of the model, or which sort of concept, or which general idea, or even ideas around empirical work? What's attractive to each of you?
So I like that you can take something like this, and I love the study of dysfunction in general, and you know why things go wrong. That just, I light up when I talk about it. I think it's really interesting, and I think you can take something like this and use it, you know, as a, again, as a frame or, you know, a lens to look at other types of dysfunctional behavior that seem to keep happening, and that happened for a while before anyone says anything or before anyone does anything. You know, we're not limited to this type of behavior. So I think that's something really interesting about it.
So elevating it to a level above or more abstracted than just sexual harassment or sexual behavior to all other kinds of deviant behavior, and how the notion of play or the notion of these porous boundaries and these sort of bracketing and framing might come into play and sort of setting up for those things to happen and then either self-reinforcing them or certain things can step in and break those cycles. That's fascinating. Thanks.
I think I'm really interested in the way that this model and work that follows it can help us understand some of the puzzling, what people would consider puzzling aspects of social harassment dynamics. So when you talk to people who hear about a situation and they say, well, that has been going on for a while, and this person didn't say stop right now, just stop right now, I don't want to listen to that, or I'm not accepting this. That's a common refrain to, well, was it really sexual harassment then? But it takes us a while to understand and evolve these social patterns, and people don't know what they mean at first. They're trying to make sense of them. And so this whole sense-making idea, I think, is so powerful for helping us rethink some of those old tropes about, well, it wasn't sexual harassment because this person never said anything about it. And I guess the other place that I find it really fascinating is when the frame breaks. So people have been contained in a frame. They've been able to say, hey, this is what's going on here. It's not harmful. But when it breaks strong, it breaks hard. And how do people then recover from that? And even in your own mind, like, I was caught up in this. And what was this exactly? And I think that can be true of any members of the interaction party. And so I think that's really fascinating. And again, we sort of see that play out when we look at Me Too, like men who were involved in these scenarios who don't see themselves as aggressors because it was part, and not the Harvey Weinsteins, but, you know, in circles of joking, or they didn't see themselves as aggressors in that place. And women didn't necessarily view themselves as victims in that place. But when it breaks, then all of a sudden those roles go to you. And it's hard to figure out who you were in that place when these unwelcome identities now are the choices that you're faced with. And so I find that a really interesting identity issue that I would love to maybe spend 12 more years on, you guys.
Sounds like a plan.
In my office. Yeah.
And I think for me, the part that I'm most excited to continue pursuing would be that bottom cycle in the model. Something that was happening in the background of this paper is I was doing my dissertation work. And I would say the theory in my dissertation and the theory that ended up in the AMR are very much intertwined into my understanding of how individuals respond and learn from or reject and backlash against sexual harassment training. And so I'm very interested in training as a sense-giving mechanism, how that affects whether people are willing to not just comply, but internalize, learn, change. And then how can we think about training as sense-giving beyond sexual harassment and diversity training, which is where a lot of my research has been focused, but like expand that to leadership training. How do we convince people to adopt the identity of a leader? And how does that motivate and change their behaviors and change their sense-making in the moment as they observe interactions among their subordinates? So I'm really interested in organizational sense-giving through training and other types of interventions and how that affects social dynamics in the workplace.
So have any of you tried to or incorporated this model or elements of this theory into your own teaching or into anything that you might have done either with students or with executives or with other groups you might have been responsible for trying to, you know, facilitate some kind of discussion around these topics?
I'm currently thinking about how I can do that. So I think like a big challenge for us, as you know, as professors, is taking these really sort of complex ideas and making them simple.
Yeah.
And, you know, anything that's related to Goffman is going to be pretty tricky to do that with. And anything that looks like our model is pretty tricky to do that with. But that's been on my mind a lot lately as I'm doing some writing for undergraduate level students about, you know, DE&I and about sexual harassment and all of those things is, you know, how can we take this and give them, you know, freshman sort of level students, give them this as a tool, simplify it enough that it's something that they can take and understand enough to start using as a tool. I'm not there yet, but.
But I do think just the awareness of the play frame and how it muddies the waters as to what's appropriate and inappropriate and how that can potentially get us into situations that we might not want to ultimately be in or we might want to avoid. Just that level of awareness, I think, could change people's perspectives. I know after reading this paper, I will think about certain situations of humor and of, oh, it's just a joke or it's just this or that. I'll view them and evaluate them and consider my participation in them differently as a result of reading this. So I do think that even if it's just that piece, at least as a starting point, I think could be very, very useful for people to conceptualize, to know, to appreciate. Yeah. Any other implications for practice. You've got this section on implications for practice and what managers might do, what leaders might do, what people who find themselves in awkward situations might do. What would be your sort of key takeaways from a pragmatic standpoint based on having written this extensive sort of theoretical paper?
I think one key one for me is the fragility of that bottom helix. So once you have, I mean, I think it's interesting to think about that the most stable part of our model is when essentially the sexual harassment is occurring, right? And people are caught up in it and they're used to it and they know their role and they know what the roles other people will play. But once that breaks, it becomes either unstable or fragile. Even if you piece it back together and try to, like we were talking about with the post Me Too, and try to say, okay, we're going to live and operate in a new place. That's a fragile place when you, especially when you have many same players, many same institutions, many same organizations involved in that. It's going to be hard for that to remake itself in a way that's completely devoid of those previous dynamics. So I think for me, that's an important practical implication about what, how profound your changes need to be in order to truly cleanse yourself of these dynamics that have occurred. And I think we sometimes don't recognize the challenges of doing that. We think we can fix it by move this person out of the unit. But I think there's a lot of dynamics there that evolve, and it takes a long time for those to reestablish themselves in new and healthy ways. You've got a disease system, and it takes a while for it to heal.
Thank you. Anything else?
I would say for me, I like the turn of phrase that social sexual behavior is a dangerous sandbox to play in. And supervisors are not immune to being pulled in and engrossed into that sandbox. And so I think one of the big takeaways for a practicing manager is to be a manager who's also a sociologist, who is constantly questioning what is the real meaning or the social implications of this interaction going on in the work group, because you cannot separate that manager and their relationships with their subordinates from the power structure that is inherent to human organization. The two cannot be separated, no matter how good of friends you are with the people you work with. If you technically have power over them, that is always going to be a factor that doesn't let human play exist in the same world that it does outside of a workplace, if that makes sense. So when managers choose to play in that sandbox, it is a very, very dangerous game for them, because not only might their power contribute to people feeling harassed, to the play turning into harassment, but then they also send the signal that that is a legitimate form of play, that it should be continued, and thus the play frame sustains or eventually expands. And so I think really being that sort of scientific manager that thinks about the social implications of these interactions, that sort of tries to look at it from the outside, tries to take that bystander perspective from time to time so they don't fully get engrossed in play, can be a useful tool. And hopefully it doesn't add too much burden or psychological stress to a management job, but I think it is important to take a step back and think, you know, what are the implications of what we're involved with here?
Yeah. And no reason that it should be too onerous. It's just being aware of it and being more conscious of, am I engaging in this kind of play or am I not? And where's it going?
One other one there.
Go ahead.
I think, because I think it's very timely, and that is that there are certain organizational cultures that are more closely aligned to a play frame. And if an organization operates with that kind of culture, it's much easier for them to fall into these dynamics and for people to get trapped in a play frame. So, you know, we talk in the paper about toxic masculine cultures. Those tend to be very much playful frames. Those are cultures defined by playful frames.
And toxic masculine competitive, which was another interesting piece to that sort of puzzle that that I think was revealing to me.
Yeah. And again, going to current events, if we look at Silicon Valley and the kind of crazy behavior we've seen there, those were those types of cultures, right? And very, very connected to work as play.
Yeah.
And so it's not surprising that we see this kind of dynamic developing, people getting trapped in it and hard to understand when it breaks and you're looking in at it saying, how in the world could that happen in a professional workplace? So I think that's another really interesting one.
Mm-hmm. I was actually just talking to a student of mine about the sexual assault scandals in the Canadian hockey organization. And we were talking about this research and how professional sports organizations have taken play, sport is play, and have turned it into an occupation. So that's already blurring the lines between play and serious behavior. So it doesn't surprise me that we see a lot of sexual harassment and sexual assault scandals happening in professional sporting organizations, because the organization itself, the occupation itself, is rooted in the blurring of play and serious behavior.
Yeah, the Boston Celtics just recently, and you know, I think it's your model and your theory is revealing for that, or to that, or in terms of understanding that. Final question: what have you learned from your 12 years worth of endeavor to number one, understand this, number two, get it published? If you just reflect, and it could be something you've alluded to already, or something else that you think about when you look back on the experience of writing this paper, what have you learned that someone else could, you know, learn from as well, or could learn from also, based on your experience?
I've learned that, you know, writing theory and theory papers are organic living things, and we have to allow them to be what they are and evolve into what they're going to be. So, you know, just trusting the process and being patient in the process, and, you know, changing and allowing things to change when that's what should happen. That's been I had never written an AMR before, right? And so it's just a very different experience than taking, you know, an idea and testing an A to B kind of relationship and then writing it up, whatever happens, versus this living thing that was one thing and became another and then another and another, and just enjoying that process.
Awesome. Thank you.
I can answer this because I started this paper literally my first semester in the PhD program at University of Arkansas. Wow. And it's now published. I'm on my second academic job here at Ivy. So it's been a long journey. And I will say that this paper was a huge contribution to my development as an academic, as a scholar. And I think if I was going to give advice to current PhD students, I would say, if you have someone on your faculty that has written great theory, try to write a great theory paper with that person, because it will teach you so much about, like, the tacit knowledge of what good theory is. And I think that's hard to describe in words. That's why it's tacit knowledge. But I would say, through this process of writing this paper and all of the ebbing and flowing and the challenges and the hurdles and getting through the review process and just learning about it every step of the way and wallowing in the confusion and the muddiness and teasing out the clarity of our ideas and our propositions and making it tight theoretically, it's just made me a better writer for all my projects, even empirical projects. I think it's very easy to write up a few simple hypotheses and test them in the lab and write something up. But it's challenging to think about the the big theoretical underpinnings of what you're doing empirically. And I think if you push yourself to spend 10 years writing an AMR, it really does make you a better scholar. And I found that my reviewing is better for journals. I feel like I can be more developmental to other papers that I'm reviewing for. And I think it's just all in all better for the field when you have that really great theoretical training. And I credit Anne for that, for my training, because I really think that, you know, working on this paper with her made me just so much better off for my career and just my professional and personal growth and development and how I think about the world. And yeah, so I would highly recommend, if you have the opportunity, spend a decade writing an AMR.
I will second that. Dan was a first year doc student. I was a first year assistant professor. Yeah. And it was just an extraordinary experience working through this with all of you. And what Shannon and I were able to learn from Anne was just sort of immeasurable.
Yeah, we all learn from each other. And this is the thing I want to say about it. I'm going to show a prop. So this is my favorite thing that ever came out of a review process. And it speaks to the power of excellent peer review. So when we submitted this paper to AMR, we received two reviews that said, yeah, you got a lot of problems, but here's some ideas and we think you should give it another shot. And we had one reviewer, reviewer three, and we might've called a few other names at some point in the process, who basically said, I don't see it. It, you know, reject.
I think she said it, or he or she said it wasn't science.
Wasn't science. Very yeah. hard. Yeah. And luckily, our associate editor listened to the other reviewers and encouraged us to stay with it. We worked through it. And when reviewer three read the later version of it, if you don't mind me taking a moment reading this, reviewer three said, I'm so pleased that the editors and other two reviewers saw more potential in this paper than I did, and that the authors persisted in developing their paper. This paper has become an interesting, provocative, theoretically grounded work that I'm excited to read. And as a side note, it's a bit of a wake-up call for me to look deeper next time for the potential in an idea that may need more work to be realized. And we love reviewer three, because reviewer three is what we should all be doing as scholars and as reviewers, right? Not just reading something critically, yes or no, but digging in to that and being open to changing our mind. And that's what reviewer three did, was open to changing his mind about this paper. And that helped us land it. And so Shannon got us mugs with reviewer three's comment on them. And that's just one of my prizes that I look at it, because I think that's what it's all about. You know, we're helping each other birth this paper, as Denise was talking about, help it organically grow. And reviewer three and the others were part of that too. So it's been a great journey together.
Awesome. Okay. Well, thank you. That has been a very revealing, interesting, and fascinating discussion about this paper, about its evolution, about the insights. And really, Anne, that last comment just about the importance of reviewing, but also the importance of being willing to review with an open mind. We as at AMR depend heavily on reviewers and reviewers taking their job seriously and doing a good job. But at the same time, being open to seeing things evolve, especially when they are given a chance and they are given an opportunity to try and improve things, try and focus things, try and make the theoretical contribution salient. And the fact that that person, whoever they were, was willing to reverse course or change their mind, I think is very, very helpful for others to get that insight. So much appreciated. And thank you for sharing the journey of your paper. It's a fascinating, brilliant piece of work. As I said to you before, I probably wouldn't have picked up and read it automatically. I'm so glad I did. So thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you.